Welcome to the AC Podcast. This is Terry Crosby.
Andy Steiger.
Today we have a very special guest joining us from Charlotte, North Carolina. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. White.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. James Emery White is the founding and senior pastor of Mecklenburg Community Church in Charlotte, North Carolina. He is the president of Serious Times, a ministry that explores the intersection of faith and culture, and hosts the website churchandculture.org, which features his messages and blogs. Dr. White is an adjunct professor of theology and culture at Gordon-Conwell Theological Seminary. He has also served as the fourth president there. He has authored more than 20 books, and they have been translated into 10 different languages. Dr. White holds a Bachelor of Science degree in Public Relations and Business, along with a Master of Divinity, and PhD degrees at Southern Seminary. Dr. White and his wife, Susan, have 4 children and 7 grandchildren. We just want to discuss your book today, Meet Generation Z, Understanding and Reaching the New Post-Christian World, that came out in 2017. You describe the book as having 2 parts, chapters 1 to 3, describe the new realities facing the Christian church with Generation Z, and then chapters 4 to 8 describe how we are to respond and truly become a countercultural church in ways that are winsome and compelling with some new approaches to evangelism and apologetics. I guess a good starting point might be, can you describe to us who are we talking about when we say Generation Z?
Well, there's several things about them from just a raw demographic standpoint that should be known if they're not. They're the largest generational cohort right now in the West, numerically larger than boomers, larger than millennials. They are the youngest, and we're talking about people collectively under the age of, say, 20 or so, 25. And so we're talking teenagers, we're talking college students, and we're talking middle schoolers, we're talking this coming wave, really the next generation. Now that's, again, a very demographic kind of analysis on them. The real mark of them, among many things, is that they are the first truly native generation to all things internet and smartphone. We tend to think that that's true of millennials. That's not true. Many millennials grew up in the 90s. You didn't even have the internet prevalent until later, and certainly not smartphones until 2007. And so the first generation that's really grown up with this has been Generation Z. Another dynamic that has shaped them profoundly has been that they have grown up in a world that has always been volatile. It's always been economically challenged. It's always had a war on terrorism. They're the first generation post 9/11 where this is just the new normal for them, which is why they've made so many dystopian novels and film series, from The Hunger Games to The Fifth Wave to even the resurrection of Mad Max or Planet of the Apes. They're the ones that have made those kind of movies so prevalent and so popular. The biggest mark of all is that they're post-Christian. I mean, they really are a post-Christian generation, the first, I would argue, truly post-Christian generation, certainly in the United States and Canada.
2 things I just want to talk about. First is, I think there's something significant to a culture that has grown up in a recession. And part of the research that you quote is that something to the tune, I think, was 71% of them still believe that they're in a recession.
Well, they really do feel that the default mode of the world is economic difficulty and challenge. It's almost like even if the numbers say differently, they have the mindset of this kind of a future, that even if it looks okay now, it's dystopian. It's a dystopian view of the future, and they tend to live that way now, which is why they tend to be social entrepreneurs. They want to save the world. They feel like the other generations have screwed it up. Their goal is to save it. And so when people label Generation Z as entrepreneurs, they're half right. They're not so much marketplace entrepreneurs as much as social entrepreneurs.
On the internet aspect of things, there's some interesting things taking place with Generation Z in that, having grown up with, you know, being Wi-Fi enabled, we're not even fully sure what effect that's going to have on this generation. And in particular, I just think about the prevalence of pornography with regards to this generation and the effect it's currently having. And then just the big question mark of what is going to be the long-term effect of this on this generation.
The top 10 most visited websites on the web, the first 6 would be names people would know, Google, Wikipedia, et cetera. 7, 8, and 9 are all pornography sites.
You quoted a stat in your book that is difficult to comprehend, and that is that one pornography site alone had 15 billion views.
And we don't know what this is doing, but there are some in my blogs, which, you know, obviously I'm continually trying to reveal research of my study and just things that are coming to happen with church and culture. There was a recent study that found that while we're still not sure what pornography is doing, what we are beginning to find, and it's moved from the anecdotal to some localized social studies. There was one done in Wales. There's another one done in another country that have proven this to be the fact. What we are finding is that it is causing children to experiment sexually at an ever younger age. We are finding that it is coarsening them to the feelings of their partner. Their partners are objectified. Third, there is a rise in sexual violence among the youngest of ages, including, you know, 8-year-olds raping other 8-year-olds. And we're also finding that this is where they're getting almost all of their sexual education. Those four things alone should be terrifying.
Let me just change gears here. One of the things that you talk about is that the most defining character of this generation is that they are post-Christian. What do you mean by that, post-Christian?
Yeah, it's very different than non-Christian. It's very different than a lot of nuances that people can throw around the word post, non, un, etc. What I mean by post-Christian is that this is the first generation that has been raised largely by the growing number of the nuns, the unaffiliated, the religiously unaffiliated. Many of their parents had a free-range kind of approach toward parenting on spiritual issues. You know, believe what you want to believe, decide what you want to decide. I'm not going to influence at all. What this has meant is that they are growing up in homes that are a-religious, a culture that is not religious. If anything, it's anti-religion and certainly antagonistic toward Christianity. And so as a result, they are the first generation to grow up without really even the memory of the gospel.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're starting with people who are at best pagan, or we need to get them to paganism and then begin the evangelistic approach forward. This is one area where, of all the things that C.S. Lewis was prescient about, this may prove to be where he was most ahead of his time. Toward the end of his writings, this was a very obscure essay that he wrote that I ran across during my studies at Oxford. And in this essay, he said that in earlier times, when the gospel first went out, it was to, you know, God-fearing Jews in Jerusalem, and it was to pagans here and such. But they all shared certain things. They shared a belief in the supernatural. They shared a belief in a judgment. They shared a belief that you would never start from within yourself and could ever come up with anything like truth or morality. Even if they may have been, whether it was a god of Abraham, Isaac, or Jacob, or the gods of Greece and Rome, there were gods. Now, that's, he said then, we're losing that. I would say we've now lost it. But he said, we're losing that. And so I'm beginning to feel, he said, that our first step in evangelism is to convert them to paganism, and then from there to Christianity, because they're not even in the pagan supernaturals camp. And so post-Christian worldview is extremely materialistic, with a few interesting exceptions, which I talk about in the book, which I think hold great apologetic promise. But they're materialistic, they're anti-religion, they're certainly post-Christian, and the post-Christianity is also true of the culture in terms of Christianity having any kind of a foothold in the epicenters of culture, which I would argue are the judicial system, the educational system, and media.
I absolutely agree. One of the things that you write about that I think is very interesting is what is filling this vacuum, this void of a post-Christian culture. And you said two things, the occult and science. Now, I would have balked at the occult one not that long ago, but I'm in my third year PhD work out of the University of Aberdeen in Scotland. And so I fly out to the UK periodically, and I have to confess that when I went out there, I expected to find a very secular culture, and in fact didn't find that. I saw posters everywhere for ghost hunting to ghost tours. Even my first day on campus at Aberdeen, they had an entire occult festival taking place with all sorts of occult things. That was just unbelievable. You know, just trying to wrap my mind around that you could go to, and, you know, it's almost like a bazaar that you could go and check out different booths of the occult. Explain that to me.
Well, I think that the, I mean, post-Christian or not, I mean, I'm going to give a very robustly Christian answer. I mean, we are made in the image of God. We are incurably religious. We're incurably spiritual. We're incurably interested in that which is not of this world, and the transcendent and the supernatural. Just because we jettison either organized religion or something like the Christian faith doesn't mean that that whole isn't there. I mean, this goes all the way back to what Pascal would say. And so the question is that how are they going to address this whole in their lives? And the irreligious way of doing it, the one that's free of dogma, free of orthodoxy, the one that has no repercussions on the moral choices they're making or the sexual choices they're making, would tend toward the occult. Now, they're not going to use the term occult because that still has electricity attached to it. But they might say, well, Wicca, or aspects of New Age thinking that it doesn't even go by New Age anymore, but it's gotten into the mainstream. And so there is this sense of like the Charlie game that kids were so into a year or two ago, where even Ouija boards are making a huge comeback, and tarot cards and things of this nature that have become divorced from anything other than just tapping in. And there is a fascination with ghosts and the spirit world. Now, we know that that's all the occult, and that's what they're tapping into. We also know that when they say, but this is real, I really experienced something, we would also say, I'm sure you did, because that's real. But I think that's also our apologetic bridge, because we're able to map that world out for them, give it definition, and when we chart that geography, I mean, it's we have at least the common language where we accept the reality of that world. We just might have different definitions to some of the things that they're experiencing. So I do. I argue in the book that that's an area of great apologetic promise, that and astrophysics, because that's another way of having the transcendent sparked in you. Studies have shown, particularly among younger generations, the younger the age you go, the more this spikes, that they will say that what makes them most open to believing in God, or when they're closest to believing in God, or when they have awe of things and they think about God, is when they turn to the cosmos.
Yeah, it was interesting to see that when you show in your book just the statistics of what questions seem to be resonating with this generation, and the idea of a creator seems to be high on the persuasive scale.
Well, yeah, and again, they're approaching that, and I can't stress this enough, they're really approaching this very specifically through astrophysics. I mean, astronomers and physicists have become the new priests of the modern secular world. And so who is the most influential religious figure right now among the irreligious? Neil Tyson, without a doubt.
Right.
His book was number one on the bestseller list last year for Amazon for nonfiction, and it was a book on astrophysics. And when you read his writings, it's really fascinating. He's very antagonistic toward the Christian faith and all things organized religion. But he's accurate in revealing the findings. And what he did about a half a dozen times in that book alone was that he would reveal everything astrophysics is finding. And then he would say, now I know this seems to point to God, but it doesn't. Next chapter. And so, I mean, really, he didn't have anything more to say than that, but he had to say, I know what this smells like. And so he titled the book Astrophysics for People Who Are in a Hurry. We did a series on it called Astrophysics for People Who Are Open to God. So we took all those findings and just completely recast it, saying, listen, let's not dismiss it so quickly. What does this point to? Just common sense. And it's overwhelmingly toward a creator.
So in one section of your book, you talk about the post-empirical God. So this relates to what you're saying. A lot of scientists argue that if a theory is coherent, it does not need to be tested experimentally. You say this is
a huge divide in science right now. I mean, this is like fighting words here.
Yeah, you say.
And the reason is because all of the Enlightenment-based thinking was it had to be, science had to be empirical. What could be seen, tasted, touched. What you could replicate in a test tube. That was the very definition of science. And the many of the thinkers of the Enlightenment then used the empirical method and empiricism as a baseball bat to just beat up religion and specifically Christianity. If science shifts and things like multiverse theory, string theory, these things that cannot be test tubed validated, but yet are solid theories that the very cutting edge of physics is finding, or at least experimenting with and pointing toward, I mean, these scientists, particularly physicists, are saying, look, science has outgrown empiricism. There are things that we're never going to be able to verify through the empirical method that may very well be true. Oh, my. Now we're back to the possibility of positing the existence of God, which was always dismissed because God couldn't be empirically verified. And now science is saying it doesn't have to be empirically verified. It just has to make the most sense. So now we're back to a coherent view of truth that can supplement the correspondence theory of truth. And as a result, you know, it's like meat's back on the table, boys. I mean, Christianity's back in the game as a very reasonable worldview.
You call it sweet irony is what you call it.
Well, because of the history of thought.
Yes.
You know, because it is interesting, right? Because you have with Popper and whatnot, you got this falsification principle. And more as science gets into things from the quantum level to even just things like electricity and whatnot, realizing we know what it does. We can't necessarily say what it is. And the idea of even being able to falsify it, you start to see that there's a shift taking place in science where they're realizing that the tidy boundaries that they would have liked to have thought that this could all fit in isn't fitting.
One of the most, right now, I think the greatest living physicist is a guy named Alan Guth at MIT. And most other physicists would say he's the other lead thinker. And I really appreciated his humility when he closed one of his books by saying, even, you know, like how all of physics was pointing toward there had to be something outside of space and time to have started everything, because something cannot come from nothing. He said, and he talked about the Big Bang and a lot of other issues, and that's one of the reasons why scientists are so keen on the multiverse and string theory, is because they're trying to find a way to explain the Big Bang, something coming from nothing. But Guth said at the end, he said, even if we could find, through the laws of physics, a way for something to come from nothing, we would still have to explain the laws of physics. Mm-hmm. How did they come into being?
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of humility has been absent, certainly from, you know, if you go back to the era of Carl Sagan and others, I mean, it was just absent.
Well, and one of the things you bring up in your book is just how we live in a culture that's driven by reductionism. And there is a commitment level there in a reductive ontology that I think that we're seeing the foundation of that eroding at a level that shows that there's opportunity for conversations that haven't been there for a long time.
Yeah, I totally agree. And here's what's interesting about the rolling back of something like reductive naturalism. It's happening from pop culture. In other words, popular culture, I mean, leading physicists, I think, are rolling it back too, based on what we were just talking about. But within culture itself, there's this rebellion against mere materialism, and that's part of the rise in the interest of the occult and ghosts and things that we were talking about. There's a sense of, I don't want there to be a world without the transcendent. I don't want that. And so before, if you go back to even something as simple as the Scopes trial, I mean, if people forget that creationists actually won that trial.
Yeah, I know.
but the evolutionary theory and the caricature of Christianity won the popular mind. Well, the opposite is happening now, and it's interesting to see unfold culturally.
And one of the things that you talk about, and I so agree with you in your book, is that we – as Christians, as apologists, you know, as evangelists, we need to be looking for cultural bridges. Where are those opportunities in culture? Where are those areas where there is actually more agreement than you would think that we can use as a bridge to talk to people about the gospel? In particular, living in a secular post-Christian culture, we're going to need to get better at doing that.
Yeah, and we're going to have to, I mean, again, this is going to be potentially very controversial, and so let me take you two off the hook and say this is my perspective.
Thank you.
I think that one of the things that we're going to have to do to build these bridges is to let go of some of our, I would say, very faulty interpretations of the scripture, particularly Genesis 1 and 2. I think one of the things that has killed many conversations is this insistence on a young earth and six literal 24-hour solar days. And I just think that in science, it's just beyond laughable. The gymnastics you have to perform to explain that are border on the ridiculous. And if you'll just release that and say, look, that is not what Genesis teaches. You know, that's not what the Hebrew word yom has to mean. And they couldn't have been literal 24-hour days because you didn't have the sun and the moon created until the fourth day.
Mm-hmm.
So read it at face value as the literary type of document it is, and just realize that from Genesis 1 and 2, you can say two things. God did it, and it was good. We don't know how. And that frees you up to then, from the holistic view of Scripture and a biblical worldview, interpret science and where science goes beyond its means and where it stays within them. And then it gets so simple, and then everything begins to just point to God. I mean, the Big Bang and so many other things. Now, that doesn't force you into evolution, doesn't force you into a non-historic Adam and Eve or any of that. I believe in a historic Adam and Eve. But it does open up the idea of theistic evolution, that there was a time when the Holy Spirit breathed life into two creatures and they were the first man and woman, or even the creation of the first man and woman. But it just lets you get out of this ridiculous box where we can't even have the first base conversation with a thinking world. I think that's first.
Yeah, and one of the things that's interesting about that is how biblical that is. When you ask yourself Genesis 1 and 2, what was the point of that? What is the author seeking to let you know about, right? And clearly it's that God did it, that God created the universe, and that it is his plans, his purposes that are unfolding. And it's interesting to me how often we will miss the major point, minor on something else, and then in the process create what I call just false dilemmas. And one of those that I have seen wreck many a faith is this idea that if they don't hold to a specific view of their church on Genesis 1 and 2, then they can't be Christian. It is a Christian, non-Christian, false dilemma that we've created there that I absolutely agree with you has created a lot of problems.
I kind of jokingly tease my graduate students as well as others. I say, look, I want you to take the Bible literally. You're not taking it literally enough.
Mm-hmm.
Read it at face value, interpret it by authorial intent, the genre that it was written, all of these things. And you just don't have these problems when you read the Bible the way the Bible wants you to read it, which is authorial intent and the genre. And you're right. It is a false dilemma. We're creating this mess that we don't need to create. But that's just one bridge. I think the scientific bridge is huge right now. I've never seen what we're finding with astrophysics more amenable to evangelism and apologetics in my lifetime. And it's just like we're fools not to seize this. Don't fight the Big Bang. The Big Bang's the best thing that ever happened.
Amen.
that ought to be a front page. And then I think, too, understanding how, and you gentlemen would know this, understanding how the nature of the questions people are asking today have changed. They've changed from the what to the so what, the relevance of things, the application of things, and also away from is there a God to, well, what kind of God are we talking about?
Mm-hmm.
Because they've heard just enough of the neo-atheists, and it is so interesting. The typical non-Christian doesn't know even the name Christopher Hitchens or Richard Dawkins or Sam Harris. They don't even know those names. But it has so infected the blogosphere, some of these basic ideas, that they don't realize it, but that's who, in essence, they've been colored by. And so dealing with particularly that God is not good, that the God of the Bible is deeply immoral, the sections of the Bible that I call the bloody Bible, and the genocide of the Canaanites and things of that nature, the average Christian isn't talking about this, and they don't know how to talk about this. But when you have even a small, eye-informed non-believer who wants to bring up, well, what about this? What kind of a God would do this and have his sacrifice his son and the whole Isaac thing? I mean, just they're genuinely perplexed. And the average Christian has no clue because they have never had this explained or talked about in their churches.
Just a chapter before the apologetics chapter you have a chapter called Rethinking Evangelism. You say the church must rethink evangelism. No longer can it be simply an event driven. The church must view evangelism as both a process and an event. What do you mean by the process?
Let's say that on a scale of 1 to 10, the average unchurched person, say, living in the 1950s or so, was on an 8. Meaning they believed in God, They had a high view of Jesus. They believed that truth existed. They had a positive view of religious leaders. They might have even had church background and experience. That's pretty far down the line. I'd give my right arm to meet a non-Christian like that today. And on a scale of 1 to 10, where is the starting point today for the typical unchurched person, this post-Christian person we've been talking about? I would argue, and this is probably being generous, they're way back at a 2 or a 3. Now, where evangelism put all of its energies in the past was on what I call event evangelism, meaning the event of crossing the line, the event of becoming a Christian. Let me take you through the Roman road. Let me take you through the four spiritual laws. Let me take you to a Billy Graham crusade, and you'll have a decision this very night. Let me have a busing ministry or door-to-door visitation ministry. Every type of evangelism was predicated on somebody being on an 8. Okay, that was brilliant for its day because that's where culture was. They're not there anymore. So if they're back on a 2 or a 3, then now you've got the process of moving them from a 3 to a 4 to a 5 till they get to the point where they can even responsibly engage the truth and the claims of Christ. And the quintessential biblical illustration of this is the difference between Acts 2 and Acts 17. In Acts 2, you have Peter in front of the God-fearing Jews in Jerusalem. He gave a short talk that wasn't the length of a good blog, told them everything they already knew that he didn't have to spend time on. You know about the Messiah and the prophets and everything else. Okay, Jesus was him. Repent. They did. You take Paul on Mars Hill, radically different context. They didn't have that biblical background of the Old Testament scriptures. They weren't monotheists. And he had to begin, and this is such a brilliant thing. He didn't even start with Jesus. He started with creation and began to work his way forward in an explanation mode. Process, 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 leading them to where they could experience the event. And that's what I mean. And that's why I argue in the book that really the heart of the new apologetics is not evidential testimony, but explanation.
I couldn't agree more with you. And I felt, I don't know if you read the Gospel Coalition. They wrote a blog on your book. I don't know if you came across that. But I felt like they were misrepresenting you when they said that he wants the church to become like the culture to reach the culture.
I actually wrote the author back. I said, I actually say the exact opposite.
Yeah, I know. And I was really surprised. I was like, man, did you read the book?
I think that they get, and again, my only thing I can think of was that they kind of lump all contemporary mega churches together and just assume that that's the modus operandi, and it's simply a straw man.
And what you do talk about, which I have preached many times, man, and I was just so refreshed to hear you talk about, is that we need to be missionaries, obviously, but where we often go astray is we forget that mission work in the West is just like mission work anywhere else in the world, and that often, we know intuitively when you send a missionary abroad, what do they need to know? They need to know the language and the culture. But the problem is that, and you write on this, that we often assume living in the West, that we know the language and we know the culture. Often that is just not the case.
I would respond by saying that's absolutely true, and that we train our leaders in biblical exegesis, but we don't train them in cultural exegesis. And it is very difficult to apply what we're exegeting biblically to culture if we haven't exegeted the culture as well.
One of the things that you do that I think is interesting, and you make no apologies for this, is that in your evangelism, in your work at the church, that you target men.
I do. And in fact, we had a baptismal event this past weekend, and we baptized 224 people, and the vast majority were men, a stunning number of men. And that always surprises people because the church is notoriously known for being feminized and basically reaching women and having the vast majority be women and not getting men at all. Now, again, when we say we target men, it's not trying to be sexist. It's strategic for us. I have found, in over 30 years in this effort, that I can reach the woman, but for whatever reason, that doesn't translate automatically or often in reaching the husband or the children, at least once they get of age. But if I can reach that man, the percentage of the women that we reach, the wife and the children, and even past the age of puberty, goes up astronomically. In fact, I've had women say, you know, this really wouldn't be the kind of church I would pick, or this isn't my kind of music, or this may not be kind of always what I like, but my husband loves it, so by golly, I'm here. and then they can grow to appreciate it, too. I'm not trying to make it sound like Mech turns women off. I'm just saying that we are very much trying to, in everything we do, we think about some guy who's in his, you know, mid-20s to early 30s, far from God, drops the F-bomb 50 times a day. Last place he'd ever think of himself is as a church or identifying with men who do. And so we try to rewrite that game plan. And I don't want to sound utilitarian, but it works.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you reach the guy, you reach the family more times than not.
Well, it is time to wrap up today. We want to thank you, Dr. White, for joining us today. It has been a big pleasure to have you on our podcast.
Thank you.
If we want to get a hold of your book, it's all in the major book outlets?
Yeah, Amazon and all those. And of course, if they're interested in the subscription to the blog, which comes out twice a week, which is free, any of the messages given at Mac, as well as our daily cultural headline news, which is also offered there. Everything's at churchandculture.org.
Okay.
And you can follow me on Twitter as well through that.
Yeah, we'll put up those links on our show notes as well. Thank you, listeners, for joining us today. The Apologetics Canada podcast is a ministry of Apologetics Canada, and we'll come back next week with more things to think about.